So we're continuing this morning the account of the sufferings and death of the Lord Jesus as it's told to us in Luke's Gospel, chapter 23. The story, of course, is set in Jerusalem, the capital city of the Jewish nation. We've seen how determined the Jewish leaders were to destroy Jesus, how they bribed one of his followers to spy on him and betray him. We've read how they arranged for his arrest and how they had him beaten up and how they interrogated him. These Jewish leaders were determined to find something with which they could accuse Jesus. And when they thought they had found it, they took Jesus to be tried by the Roman governor, Pontius Pilate. They accused Jesus of treason. They said he was trying to undermine the Roman Empire. They said he was setting himself up as a rival king to Caesar, the Roman Emperor. They knew these things weren't true, but they hated Jesus. And they didn't care what methods they used to get rid of Jesus. Well, it didn't take long for the Roman governor to realize that Jesus had been framed, that Jesus was completely innocent of all these charges. And so Pontius Pilate acquitted Jesus on all charges. But the Jewish leaders weren't prepared to accept that verdict. And Pilate didn't have the nerve simply to defy them, simply to tell them that his verdict was final. He was terrified that they would report him to the emperor and that he'd lose his job, he'd lose his career. So Pilate tried to negotiate with these Jewish leaders. He tried to reach some compromise with them, but they weren't interested in any compromise. Jesus had to die. Well, Pilate appealed to the crowd, but the Jewish leaders had already fixed the crowd. And when Pilate asked the crowd, "What do you want me to do with Jesus?" then they shouted back, "Crucify him, crucify him." And they shouted louder and louder. And Pilate realized that he would have a riot on his hands if he didn't do what they wanted. And if that happened, it would be the end of his career in any case. So we read in verse 25, he delivered Jesus over to their will. He sentenced Jesus to be crucified. Now we thought, again and again, over these past weeks, about the different people who are involved in different ways in the death of Jesus, God's Son. And I want us to run through them again. We've thought, firstly, about the Jewish leaders, eaten up with hatred for Jesus. Why did they hate him so much? They hated him because what he said hurt their pride. They were the most religious people around. They were the people whom everyone looked up to. Everyone thought of them as holy. They thought of themselves as models of goodness. They were the people who laid down the ethical standards for the whole of society. And some of them were very moral people. They kept all the rules of their religion very carefully. They gave a fixed percentage of their income to charity. They used all the right words at the right times. They never said anything that could offend anyone. They ticked all the right boxes in terms of what was regarded as proper behaviour in that society. And yet Jesus told them that they were still bad people because of what they were like inside. He told them that inside, in terms of their most fundamental desires, in terms of their real motives, they were greedy. He told them that they didn't really care about people as individuals. He told them that they didn't really love God. They might go through all the routines of religion, but they didn't love the God who made them. He pointed out things about them that they just didn't want to see. He told them that they needed to be forgiven and that they needed to be changed just as much as the most sordid character in society. And he offered to do those things for them. He told them that he could rescue them from their sin, and that he could forgive them and he could change them if they put themselves into his hands, under his care. He made them the greatest offer in the world. I can rescue you, he said. I can take you as you are, in all your sinfulness, in all your twistedness inside, and I can save you. And they hated him for saying it. They hated him because he said that they needed him. It hurt their self-esteem. It hurt their pride. They couldn't bear to hear him saying those things about them. They couldn't bear the fact that other people heard him saying those things. They hated Jesus because he refused to tell them that they were good enough as they already were. You know, in any society, there are certain rules that are seen as supremely important. And if you want to think of yourself as a good person, then those are the rules you've got to keep. And if you do keep those rules, then society will tell you that you are one of the right people. In Jesus' time, those rules were religious rules. They were set by religious leaders, but they were endorsed by society generally. They were rules like, you've got to go through various rituals before you eat a meal. And they were rules like, you mustn't eat certain foods. And you must give a fixed percentage of your income to charity. And providing you kept those rules, then you were a good person. And you were entitled to congratulate yourself. Regardless of what you were like inside. Well, every society, you know, has its own rules which function in just the same way. In our society, they're not set by religion. But they are there just the same. The rules that are agreed to be the key rules. Came home to me just this past week when I was talking with a young lady, and she was telling me about a book she was reading, a novel written in the 1930s. And she told me she was, well, uneasy about the book. I thought, yeah, so would I be. There's violence in the book. There's immorality in the book. There's blasphemy in the book. Crude language. But it wasn't any of those things that bothered her. She said to me, you know, some of the characters used racist words. She wasn't bothered by accounts of people doing violent things or doing sexually immoral things. But she was bothered about people saying racist words. Because, you see, that is one of the most absolute rules in our society. Anyone who breaks it in our society is by definition a bad person. And if you keep it, then you show that you're a moral person, a responsible person. That's the assessment that's made in our society. A lot of the most important rules in our society are environmental rules. Reducing your carbon footprint. Buying from environmentally responsible companies. Reducing the amount you send to landfill. Vital rules in our society. Some of the rules relate to sexual behaviour. But they're not, you must be faithful to your marriage partner. You can sleep around as much as you want. But you must make sure that you're using responsible protection against STDs and unwanted pregnancies. Of course, there are endless health and safety rules that a good person will always observe, and so on. Well, what's wrong with all that? Well, apart from the question of where these rules come from, and whether they're actually good rules, and who has decided that these are the most important rules, the problem is simply this, that people think they're good people because they've kept these rules. The rules that society says are all important. Of course I'm a good person. I never sleep with anyone who hasn't given consent. And I always use appropriate protection. And I'm always tolerant and inclusive. And I never use racist or homophobic language. And I always recycle my waste. And I drive a hybrid green car. I'm a vegetarian. I'm a non-smoker. People still believe that if they've kept the rules, they've passed the test. They don't talk about being on the right side of God now. That's outdated language. But they do talk about being on the right side of history, whatever that may mean. And Jesus says, I'm not interested in your rules. I'm interested in what's in your heart. And my standard is this, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your mind and with all your strength. And you shall love your neighbour. And your neighbour is the real individual person you meet. And you must love that neighbour as you love yourself. You must care as much about him as you do about yourself. You know, a person may keep whatever rules they think are important. And they can still be an utterly selfish person. Self-centered. Living their life for their own pleasure, for their own satisfaction. Never caring about anybody except themselves. Never longing to do good to the particular people whose lives touch theirs day by day. Never feeling a pang of love for God who made them, for God who keeps them alive. You know, people talk about self-righteousness as if it's something that's peculiar to religious people. But it's not, you know, there are just as many self-righteous humanists or agnostics as there are religious people. They're very proud of themselves. They're sure that they're superior to others. Why? Because they've kept the rules. The rules that they've set for themselves or the rules that society has set for them. And if you try to tell them about Jesus Christ, if you try to tell them that he's come to save sinners and that they are sinners, then they resent it. They find it deeply offensive. How can they be sinners when they've kept all the rules? You see, they're no different from the religious leaders of Jesus' day, who hated him because he told them that they were sinners just like anyone else. He told them that they needed him to rescue them and to change their hearts and to forgive the offensiveness of their stance towards God. Do you find it offensive when the Lord Jesus says to you, you've got a wicked heart, you know? From the moment that you were born, you've been a perverted person, you know. Because you've never loved God with all your heart. And because you've never cared about your neighbour the way you care for yourself. Do you find it offensive when Jesus tells you that that makes you a bad person? That was the problem for the Jewish leaders. They found it offensive to be told simply that they were sinners. If Jesus had said, well, you know, you may have your faults, but you're better than other people, they might have swallowed that. But to be told simply that they were sinful and lost, that they needed Jesus to save them, oh, they were furious to hear that. That's why they were determined to crucify Jesus. We thought about them firstly. And we thought secondly about the Roman governor. Don't worry, I'm not going to talk about all the different people at the same length. I can be brief, talking about Pontius Pilate. He didn't hate Jesus. We've said that. He didn't hate Jesus the way that the Jewish leaders did. But he was a coward. And he was a careerist. He sentenced Jesus to death because he didn't want to lose the things that were important to him. And what petty things they were. When you think about it, his career, his place in society, his reputation, his salary. In the end, those things were more important to him than anything. They were more important to him than justice, than truth, than God. They were more important to him than his own soul. What is really most important to you? What drives you? People are driven, aren't they? I've got to pass these exams. Why? Well, so that I can get to university. Why? Well, so that I can get a job that pays. Why? Well, so that I can buy a house in that fashionable area. Oh, why? Well, so that I can get my children into a good school. Why? Well, so that my children will pass their exams. Why? Well, so that they can get to university. Why? Well, so that they can get a job that pays. Why? Well, I suppose so they can support me in my old age and pay for my funeral. People are driven, aren't they? But how many people really ask the question, what's it for? And what's at the end of it all? Pontius Pilate crucified Jesus. The only saviour, the only hope, the Son of God, and he did it to rescue his career. You know, we don't know where or when Pilate died. But wherever it was, whenever it was, when Pilate knew he was dying, how important do you think his career felt to him then? Do you think he died with a smile on his face, congratulating himself that, well, he'd managed to keep his job as prefect of Judea for a whole 10 years? Wow, that's something, isn't it? He did get sacked in the end. Do you think that was enough to give him peace as he dropped into the black abyss of death? Knowing he was going to face Jesus Christ, the man he had crucified. What did Jesus say? What shall it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his soul? The things of this world last a few years at best. What have you gained if you win them all and then lose your own soul? It is appointed unto men once to die, and after that, the judgment. One day you are going to stand before Jesus Christ, and you will hear Jesus say one of two things to you. You will either hear him say, "Enter, you blessed one, into the joy prepared for you." Or you'll hear him say, "Depart from me, you cursed, into the everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his messengers." Is any career, is anything that this world offers, worth the losing of your soul? Worth the everlasting fire? Worth the final slamming of the door? The Jewish leaders crucified Jesus because they hated him. The Roman governor crucified Jesus because he wanted to hang on to his job. Pathetic. We pass over Herod. I've said everything I want to say about that pleasure-addicted playboy. Instead, we'll talk thirdly about the crowd, the common people. It was Pontius Pilate who summoned the crowd to his residence. It's in verse 13, Pilate then called together the chief priests and the rulers and the people. Pilate believed that the common people would back him in his attempts to set Jesus free. After all, Jesus had been hugely popular among the ordinary people. And yet when Pilate asked them what they wanted him to do with Jesus, they chanted, "Crucify him, crucify him." Why? Why did these ordinary people want to see Jesus hanging on a cross in agony? Why did they want to hear Jesus screaming in pain? They weren't like the leaders. They weren't already eaten up with hatred for Jesus. They weren't like Pontius Pilate. Their careers weren't at stake. So why were they, the ordinary people, screaming now for Jesus' death? Well, point one. I think the simplest explanation is this, that they were a crowd. And once a few started shouting, "Crucify him," others followed suit, because that's what crowds do. The Jewish leaders had planted a few of their supporters in the crowd, and it only took a few to swing the mood of the whole crowd. That's the terrible thing about crowds. That they are so easy to manipulate. Human beings have this terrible capacity to be swayed by what other people around them are saying and doing. And I'd have to say it's easier for it to happen today than it's ever been. Because you don't even have to get the crowd together in one place to start with. It can be done through the media, it can be done through TV, it can be done through the internet. People are sure that something is true and that something's the right thing to do just because everyone else seems to be saying so. That's the way that things work. Do you remember the way that millions of people surged up to London when Princess Diana died? And they were sobbing, and they were piling up mountains of flowers, and they were threatening shopkeepers who dared to keep their shops open, because that was blaspheming the memory of Diana. 5 years later, the Diana Memorial Fountain in London stood there, a neglected, vandalized site. The fountain wasn't working. The whole scene was scrawled with graffiti. And people walked past and didn't even know what it was. The crowd swung this way, the crowd swung that way. Do you remember Clegg Mania? Sweeping the country before the last election. It only took a few journalists, a few media figures to shout out that Nick Clegg was the hope for the future. And that was enough to sway millions of people to vote for him. And 4 years later, the media that made him have destroyed him. People who swooned at him now laugh at him. Do you know the single greatest reason why people in this country despise Christianity and ignore Jesus Christ? It's this. They're following the lead of other people around them. That's all. Since everybody else says that Christianity is boring, then Christianity must be boring. Since everyone else says that the Bible is full of contradictions, well, they know that the Bible is full of contradictions. Since everyone else says you can safely write off Jesus Christ, they're sure they can safely ignore Jesus Christ. You know, almost every young person we meet when we're going out talking to youngsters on the streets, they repeat the same cliches, they repeat the same mantras. If I've heard one lad shout, "There's no evidence Jesus ever existed," I must have heard 100. Well, how many of them do you think have ever tried to find out if there's any evidence? They're just shouting along with the rest of the crowd. You know, there are so few people who are willing to think for themselves, to actually examine what everyone else is saying, to stand out as different. Once one person starts shouting, "Crucify! Crucify!" others will start shouting too. Just to go along with the crowd. It's pathetic. And how utterly foolish when it's your soul at stake. Oh. If everybody else tells me that chicken tikka masala is the greatest dish in the world, it doesn't really matter all that much whether I believe them or not. But if people tell me I can safely ignore the Son of God, then I better be sure whether they're right or not. You know, I spoke a few moments ago about the day when you will stand before Jesus Christ to be judged. When Jesus will be the judge and you will be standing there before him. You won't be standing with a crowd then. You'll be standing there on your own. For once in your life, you will have to answer for yourself without the support of the crowd around you. Just you and Jesus Christ face to face. And when he asks you why you didn't listen to him, why you didn't believe him, why you didn't put yourself into his hands, why you didn't let him save you, what are you going to say to him? Well, lots of people were ignoring you, so I did too. Lots of people said it was all nonsense, so I did too. Do you think that'll be a defense for the people who are in this crowd? Well, lots of people shouted, "Crucify Jesus," so I just shouted along with them. It doesn't matter what the crowd say. What matters is that you have dealings with Jesus Christ personally. If everybody else in the world is shouting, "Crucify him, crucify him," you can still go to him and you can say, "Be my saviour, save me." So that was one reason why the people in this crowd shouted, "Crucify him." Most of them were just swayed by a few people who were manipulating the situation. But what tool did the manipulators use to get what they wanted? Why were the crowd who just a little while before were so keen on Jesus, why were they so ready now to go along with Jesus' enemies? And we thought about that a little bit last week. Answer, most of the people in that crowd, even those who had been so keen on Jesus in the past, those who had praised him most loudly, had done it for the wrong reason. They thought that Jesus was going to give them everything they wanted. They thought he was going to lead a revolution against Rome. They thought he was going to give them freedom and prosperity and status in the world. And now they realized he wasn't going to do those things. And so they turned against him. And they opted for Barabbas instead, a man who was willing to do what they wanted. He was willing to start a rebellion against Rome. Some people reject Jesus because he offends their pride and they hate him. Some people reject Jesus because following him would threaten the things they think are important, their career or whatever it is. Some people reject Jesus just because everyone else does. And some people reject Jesus because he doesn't give them what they want. You know, young people go away to camp. And they find the experience at Christian camp really thrilling. The emotional buzz of 100 teenage lads and girls singing around the campfire. The exposure to the mountains and the lakes, maybe a thunderstorm in the middle of the week. The whispered conversations in the tents. And they want it to continue. And when they hear the camp preachers talk about what Jesus can do for them, that's what they understand. That Jesus can give them this buzz, this emotional high, this thrill permanently. And then they go home at the end of the week. And they start reading their Bible and they go along to the church that's been recommended to them. And they find that the reality is very different. That the buzz fades away after a few days. And that the emotional high isn't maintained. And instead they find that Jesus is calling them to a life of obedience and self-discipline and service. Jesus isn't giving them what they want. And bit by bit they drift away and they become cynical. But then years later, some Christian tries to witness to them. And their answer is, I tried it years ago and it didn't work. And what they mean is that Jesus didn't give them what they wanted. Oh, I was a Christian once. But then he let my granddad die. Jesus didn't give me what I wanted. Well, I was a Christian once, but he let my boyfriend dump me. Jesus didn't give me what I wanted. That was this crowd. Jesus hadn't given what they wanted. They wanted a revolution against Rome. They wanted political freedom. They wanted to be lifted up to the top of the pile. And he hadn't done it. Then we'll take Barabbas. And as for him, well, crucify him. Crucify him. We don't want him. Jesus has never promised to give you what you want. Jesus promises to give you what you need if you turn to him. You're guilty because of all the wrong things you've said and done. You need to have your guilt removed. You've got a bad, greedy, selfish heart with no love for God in it. You need to have your heart changed. You've offended God. You face his everlasting anger. Well, you need to have peace with God. Well, Jesus is willing to do everything for you that you really need. Don't crucify him because he won't give you what you want. Instead, go to him for what you need. I want to talk fourthly, finally, about one last group of people. The people who followed in the streets as Jesus was taken to be put to death. The soldiers who crucified Jesus led him through the streets of Jerusalem, and then they took him outside the city to crucify him. And crowds of people followed. Jesus must have looked an appalling sight. Remember, he spent the last hours before he was arrested praying desperately, sweating what looked like great drops of blood. Since then, he's been on his feet continually. He's been beaten up. He's been battered by hours of questioning. He's been dragged to and fro between the Jewish leaders and the Roman governor and King Herod. And he's been flogged. The other Gospels mention that particularly. Luke doesn't feel he needs to, because all his readers know that under Roman law, if a man was sentenced to be crucified, automatically he was flogged. And that means a Roman flogging, something like a cat of nine tails. And each of the thongs is studded with sharp objects like razor blades. This is a flogging that literally rips the flesh off all the bones, leaves the spine visible. Many victims died under the flogging, just through shock and loss of blood. Jesus, God's Son, was led through the streets, exhausted, bruised, soaked in blood, stumbling, carrying the cross on which he was to die. And these people watched. We read in verse 26 of one man, Simon, from Cyrene in North Africa. He'd probably come to Jerusalem for the Passover festival. He was there watching. He was there when Jesus collapsed. And the soldiers pulled Simon out of the crowd and ordered him to carry the cross, because it was obvious Jesus wasn't going to be able to carry it any further. And then there was a group of women. They're mentioned in verse 27. They were shocked by what they saw. They were crying and lamenting. Maybe that was just a pious duty. In that society, if there was a funeral, it was the duty of all the local women to wail and mourn, even if they had no close connection with the deceased. It was the equivalent of all the people in one of our streets pulling down the blinds on the day of a funeral. Maybe these women were just paying their respects to a dying man. Or maybe they felt they ought to cry because here was a Jewish man being executed by the Romans. You think of some of the mass funerals in Northern Ireland for a paramilitary who's been shot dead by the security forces. Or maybe they actually knew something about Jesus. Maybe they were mourning for him. After all, they all knew who he was. He's been the most talked about man in Jerusalem for the past week. And either he or the soldiers are carrying a notice that's going to go above the cross. This is the King of the Jews, Jesus of Nazareth. Whatever their reason was, Jesus said to them, "Don't mourn for me. Mourn for yourselves, mourn for your families. Because there are dreadful things ahead for you." We'll look more at his words to those women on another occasion. But let's just focus on these people. Simon. These women crying. For that matter, all the other people in the crowd. Let's focus on what they did. What did they do? Nothing. That was what they did. Simon could have said, "I'm not cooperating with this. I am not going to help you crucify Jesus." The women could have said, "We're just going to stand in the way. We're not going to let you drag Jesus on to be crucified." The crowds could have blocked the roads. There were only four soldiers. Learn that from John's Gospel. And even if there had been more, we've seen that Pilate couldn't afford to do anything to anger the crowd, and he knew it. If these people had been determined to stop the crucifixion, they could have done. But they didn't. Oh, the women wept. Oh, it's so tragic. These things shouldn't happen. Oh, no. But they did nothing. Who crucified Jesus? Who must take the guilt for what was done? The Jewish leaders, because they planned it. Pilate, because he passed the sentence. The crowd at the palace, because they shouted, "Crucify." And the ordinary people in the streets, because they did nothing. A few weeks later, one of Jesus' followers, Simon Peter, preached in Jerusalem. And this is what he said to all the people in Jerusalem who heard him. He said, "This Jesus, delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, you crucified. You killed him by the hands of lawless men." And nobody in the crowd put up his hand and said, "It wasn't me." Because it was all of them. There are people who will say, "Well, I don't hate Jesus." There are people who will say, "Well, I've never acted against Jesus." There are people who will say, "Well, I've never shouted, 'Crucify him.'" No, you've just done nothing. You've ignored him. The Son of God came into the world, and you've ignored him. You've acted as if he doesn't matter. Maybe at times you've heard something about what he suffered, and you've said, "Oh, what a pity, what a pity." But you've done nothing. You've never gone to him. You've never said to him, and you've never said before men and women, "He's my Saviour. He's my King." There wasn't one person who stepped out of that crowd and said, "He's my King. I can't stop you from crucifying him, but he's still my King." Some of you have never taken a public stand for Jesus Christ. Some of you have done nothing. Who crucified Jesus? Every man and woman in Jerusalem crucified Jesus. The disciples who ran away. Simon Peter, who said, "I never knew him." The Roman governor who condemned him. The soldiers who drove home the nails. And the people who did nothing. I crucified Jesus. It's my greatest sin. I crucified Jesus. It's the sin of the whole human race. We crucified Jesus. And the miracle is that Jesus still holds out his hands to us and says, "Let me save you.